So I did, as usual, I brought some extra things here, a biography that I used a great deal for research on this, and then this book called The Rise and Progress of Religion in the Soul. And I, again, as usual, I brought these things so that if you're interested and you want to come up later and peruse any of them, this book, as we will see, was very significant in William Wilberforce's life. And my map-making skills are not on
as
the same
good as
level
mine, you want to say? That's
an actual map from that time of Africa that you can also take a look at after class if you want. And I've got a couple things I'm going to pass out during that we can take a look at as well. So because we're going to be dealing with the African slave trade, there are going to be some disturbing elements of the things that we're going to have to talk about today. Now, because this can be very disturbing, I didn't put in any of the really particularly terrible things, but there were a lot of terrible things that happened. We're going to keep it okay for Sunday school class, but it's still going to be some things that can be a little bit disturbing to think about. But we're going to talk about William Wilberforce, a man who was born on August 24th, 1759. So to put that in perspective, this is during the time of John Newton's ministry. He's already been converted. Remember that John Newton was a slave ship captain for a while, but that was about 10 to 20 years earlier that Newton had left that job to eventually at this point, it's around the time that Newton is becoming a pastor. This is before the time of Simeon that we talked about the other day. So kind of puts us in the middle of those individuals. And William Wilberforce was, growing up, he was a weak and sickly child. He was small. He was always small. Even as a grown man, he was 5 foot tall. He had poor eyesight as well. But one of the things that was remarkable about him is that he was a great speaker. When he was 7 years old, he started going to the whole grammar school. He would walk 3 miles each way to go to school at 7 years old. And one of his teachers at that time, when he was 7 years old, said, even then, his elocution was so remarkable that we used to set him upon a table and make him read aloud as an example to the other boys. So everyone knew he's very gifted in his ability to speak. His father died when he was 10 years old, and so he was sent, his mother, for whatever reasons, not entirely sure, but she decides to send him to live with his aunt and uncle. And their names were William and Hannah Wilberforce. So he's William Wilberforce, and his uncle is also William Wilberforce. But he goes to live with them, and they're about 200 miles away from where he's born, in the town of Wimbledon. And William and Hannah are evangelicals. They're very kind to William as he grows up. And in fact, they take William Wilberforce, the young boy, to the town of Olney. And he's introduced to John Newton as a young boy. He would have heard Newton preach. Newton gave a series of lectures on Pilgrim's Progress that Newton would have been able to sit in, and or that William Wilberforce would have been able to sit in, and William would have grown up singing some of the songs that John Newton had composed. So Newton has this neat opportunity to pour into the life of this young boy, William Wilberforce. And that goes on for a few years, about 2 years. But William's mother was not an evangelical. And like many people in England at that time, she was very suspicious of what was called Methodism, or the enthusiasts, those people who are just so much talking about God all the time. They're a little off their rocker because they're so much thinking about God and they're trying to follow the Bible so exactly. Well, apparently, William's mother didn't realize how sincere his aunt and his uncle were in their beliefs. And so after 2 years, she finds out that William Wilberforce is being raised as a Methodist, one of those enthusiasts. And she can't believe it. She rushes to Wimbledon and she takes her son back. He's going to live with her now. No more time with his aunt and uncle. She even taunted the aunt and uncle who had been raising him with these words, "You should not fear. If it is a work of grace, you know it cannot fail." And so at 12 years old, she takes him back. And she sets about trying to free him from his Methodist upbringing that he's now had. Again, remember, we're talking about Methodism, not as the denomination, but simply as those who were following in the footsteps of men like John Wesley, George Whitefield, the Great Awakening, all of that. So she sets about trying to do everything she can to undo the influence of his aunt and uncle. She and the extended family, they try hard to win his soul back to the world. They took him to balls, to parties, to card games, everything that high society had to offer. And he later said of that time, "I was everywhere, invited and caressed. I might almost say that no pious parent ever labored more to impress a beloved child with sentiments of piety than they did to give me a taste of the world and its diversions." And it took a while, and for a while, William resisted all of those things, but eventually, under enough time, he succumbed to it, and he gave up all his thoughts about religion, everything he'd learned from Newton, and just went in the ways of the world. His mother's plan succeeded. Now, William Wilberforce would look back at that with deep regret that he hadn't been able to continue in those good influences. But he would also, later in his life, be able to look back and see a way that the Lord used this for his good. He says that period of time when his mother pulled him back to all the things of the world was the means of my being connected with political men and becoming useful in life. Basically, if he hadn't gone through that period of life, he would never have developed the interest in politics and developed the connections with political people that would later become so significant for him in his life. Now, he next went to the Pocklington Grammar School, and one of his classmates said he greatly excelled all the other boys in his compositions, though he seldom began them till the 11th hour. So you get the point. He's very gifted. He's very bright. And because he's bright, he doesn't have to work hard. He can wait till the very end and still do a great job with his homework. And he spent 3 years at this school, which he later described as a life of idleness and pleasure. At 17 years old, he went to St. John's College, Cambridge, in 1776. So think about the same time that the American colonies are declaring their independence. And as soon as he got to St. John's College, he fell in with a group as licentious a set of men as can be conceived. They were in the habit of drinking hard, and their conversation was in perfect accordance with their principles. However, it didn't take long, and he started to pull back a little bit from that. They were a little too crazy for him. And so he settled into a more respectable life, just as a very worldly man enjoying living in this college. And his teachers would compliment him a great deal. They would say, "The other students, they're kind of dumb, they're kind of dull, but you're really brilliant." He would later say about that, "This was a poison to a mind constituted like mine." Even though it seemed like a positive thing that they're complimenting him, telling him how brilliant he is, for him, what it did was it fed that sense that I don't have to work hard, I can just wait till the last minute. And so he does that. He goes through school wasting his time, just having a good time with his friends, still doing great work, but not applying himself to anything. Later on, he would regret this lack of self-discipline. And even his friends would regret his lack of self-discipline for the rest of his life, although we will even see the ways that he worked very hard to develop that self-discipline. But he had a lack of concentration. He lacked what he called system, which is methodical study of things. And he regretted this deeply. He even felt that his teachers were guilty, to some extent, of allowing him to live this way and to not apply himself to his studies. For his entire life, he was described as infinitely distractible. He was, however, the most popular student in Cambridge. Fellow students described him. They said that he kept a huge Yorkshire pie in his room that anyone was invited to. And so in the evenings, all of the students would love to come to William Wilberforce's apartment, and they'd enjoy the pie, and they'd sit around till late in the evening just talking, just hanging out, being college students. And at this point, you wouldn't think that he would have any compunctions about spiritual things. Apparently, he had some thoughts thought about spiritual things, because when it was time for him to graduate with his Bachelor of Arts, he was delayed 2 years because he wasn't willing to sign the articles, the 39 articles of the Church of England, which at that time was required in order to graduate from this school. At the same time, he was visiting a Unitarian chapel on occasion. So apparently he's thinking somewhat about spiritual things, but probably not well. But on graduation, he decided that he would become a Minister of Parliament. Now, something to know about William Wilberforce is he inherited a massive amount of money. We're talking the equivalent of millions and millions of dollars in today's money. So with this immense amount of money, he really did not need to get a job. He could have just lived his entire life based off of the proceeds of the fortune that he had inherited. But he wanted to do something with his life, so he thinks, I can be a Minister of Parliament in England, and this way I can vote for what I believe is the right thing to do, instead of just voting for maybe using my political office to get power and money for myself. Now, we have to understand that at this time, there was a great deal of corruption in the English government. And we actually, in order to understand Wilberforce, we need to talk a little bit about the British parliamentary system. So, in America, we've got three branches of government. We've got the executive branch, which would be, of course, the president. We've got the legislative, which is going to pass the laws, Congress. We've got the judicial. And we have elements of these three in Great Britain. But in Britain at this time, the executive is the monarchy. It's the king. And he has all authority, all legal authority is in the king. Combined with, we have the legislative branch, which is Parliament. And just like Congress here in America has two parts, you've got the House of Representatives and you've got the Senate, at the same time, Parliament is divided into two parts. You have the House of Commons and you have the House of Lords. Commons is essentially kind of equivalent to the House of Representatives. The House of Lords is kind of equivalent to the Senate. The judicial branch doesn't function as a separate branch. There are courts, but the ultimate court of appeal, the closest thing that you have to a Supreme Court at this time, is actually the House of Lords that you can appeal to. So the courts don't function as much as an entirely independent branch. The monarchy, even though he has all of the legal power, he has to work with Parliament. And so the function of the president would be the equivalent of the prime minister. But the prime minister is actually the head of the largest party in the House of Commons. So just like we have the Speaker of the House, well, the head of the House of Commons is the prime minister. He's appointed by the monarch and chosen to lead the government. Hopefully that all makes sense, what we're talking about here. Now, there's a lot of other differences, though, between England at that time and America today. The House of Lords is not elected. No one in the Lords is chosen by the people. These individuals are all appointed by the monarch or entitled to their position because they are great landowners or because of their position in the Church of England. So the Lords is a pretty stable body of the highest aristocrats in the land. The House of Commons is somewhat democratic, meaning different areas of the country can vote for the Minister of Parliament that they're going to send to the House of Commons. However, at this time in England, only 4% of the population was eligible to vote. And the way that they had divided it was not based on population size. So you think about here in America, we divide everything based on population size. That tract of land is going to appoint someone to the House of Representatives. Well, in the House of Commons, it's divided up very piecemeal. So you might have a huge town that gets one representative, and you might get a teeny, teeny, tiny little village that gets one representative. In fact, you might have a village that gets one representative, but there's no eligible voters in that village. So the landowner who's technically responsible for that village just gets to choose who he wants to represent in the House of Commons. There was also a lot of other differences. Voting was not secret. everyone could know what your vote was. And this created an immense amount of corruption. It was considered completely normal to pay people for votes. And so if you want to become a representative to the House of Commons, you expect you're going to be spending a lot of money to buy the votes of the people that you're trying to represent. So in this way and many others, the British system at this time is very different from what we think of as a democratic system. You can think of it as the very beginning, just the very start of a democratic system, but nothing like what we're used to. William Wilberforce was standing for the seat in the House of Commons that would represent the town of Hull. And for this, he would spend £9,000, which is the modern day equivalent of $1.5 to $2 million, in order to try to get this seat. One other thing to mention here is that in politics, just as we have the Democrats and we have the Republicans, they also had two parties. But at this time, there was a lot of overlap. It was not clear cut. If you go back about 50 years, the parties were much more clear cut. You had the Whigs and the Tories. Now, the Whigs are, there's some question as to where they got the name the Whigs. W-H-I-G. Some people say that that name came from the acronym We Hope in God. It was the We Hope in God party. And it was generally considered the party of the middle class as well as the dissenters. So if you weren't part of the Church of England, you were more likely to be in the Whig camp. On the other hand, the Tory was more the aristocrats, the more well-to-do people, and people who were generally much more in line with the Church of England, the established church. They don't want to see other religious groups present. William Wilberforce would run as an independent, and so he didn't go into either of those. And again, at this time, there's a lot of agreement actually between the two parties, no really clear distinctions between them. But in order to prepare himself for potentially serving in the House of Commons, he started to go and attend in the gallery to watch the proceedings. And while he's there in the House of Commons, he runs into a certain individual who becomes a good friend of his. The man's name is William Pitt. Now, William Pitt is a very young man at this time, just like William Wilberforce. They're both in their early 20s. And William Pitt's father had been the Prime Minister of Great Britain back, actually on two different occasions. Pitt the Elder, William Pitt the Elder, had been Prime Minister of Great Britain during the time of the Seven Years' War, which today in America we refer to that as the French and Indian War. A war, incidentally, which was kicked off by young George Washington, who started that war at the age of 22. But he develops this friendship with William Pitt that will be very significant in his life. And when he stands there for that vote in the town of Hull, he wins the election with 1,126 votes. Interesting that he had to spend that much money to get just 1,100 and some votes. There's two people who run against him, and the two remaining split the remaining votes. So he is 21 years old at this time when he becomes a Minister of Parliament. And he quickly gets swept into the life of what is involved with being there in London as a Minister of Parliament. One of the things that a lot of the ministers would do that they loved to do is they would visit these gaming houses to gamble. And very quickly, William Wilberforce gets sucked into the gambling routine. This was more than just gambling because it was also the place where backroom deals were cut. I mean, we're talking about politics. So they're gathering together around a table of cards and they're gambling, but they're also talking about politics. Are you going to support me? Am I going to support your bill? How are we going to work through this together? But this was also very serious gambling. There was a lot of money that was trading places. One historian said that this sort of gambling had nothing to do with fun or an amusing evening. It was a deadly, serious addiction. One man, Lord Arlington, had once bet £3,000. That's the equivalent of $250,000 today. On a race between two raindrops on one of the shop's window panes. Wilberforce himself lost about £100 on more than one occasion, the modern equivalent of $15,000 to $30,000. And so he's involved in this. But eventually he gave it up. not apparently from any necessarily particularly Christian reasons of giving it up, but partly as he was seeing the effects that it was having on some of the people that actually owed him money, and when he realized they're actually going bankrupt. Like, I can afford this, but some of these guys are going bankrupt because I'm winning the gamble. And just out of a sense of compassion to them, he started to rethink whether he wanted to be involved in this. So he eventually pulls out at the same time that William Pitt, who had also gotten involved in this gambling, started to pull out of that. Meanwhile, John Newton is still ministering, and he hears little rumors about William Wilberforce, that young boy that has now gone on to be a minister of Parliament. And he says to William Cooper, he says, "The strongest and most promising religious convictions I ever met with were in the case of Mr. Wilberforce when he was a boy. But now they seem entirely worn off. Not a trace left behind, except a deportment, a lifestyle, comparatively decent and moral in a young man of a large fortune." And so, really looks like a hopeless situation as far as there's just no real interest in spiritual things in William's life. Now, in between sessions of Parliament, when they go on break, he would take different vacations, and it was common for him to go on vacation to France. He loved to travel there. On one occasion, he went with William Pitt to France, and they got to meet the King and Queen of France. And then in 1783, William Pitt the Younger is offered and accepts the role of Prime Minister of Great Britain. He is 24 years old. Now, Wilberforce doesn't join Pitt's government, even though he is a friend of William Pitt. He wants to maintain his role as an independent. And so he does this, even though he continues the friendship with Pitt. But he's an independent, and Pitt now is going to run the government. And there's a lot of agreement between these two men. They both approach life in a very similar way. Meanwhile, William runs again, but this time he's like, I could set my sights on something bigger than that little district of Hull. And so he runs for the town of Yorkshire, which is a much more powerful seat, and he wins it. And he goes on a hot air balloon ride to celebrate, which was a very new technology at that time. And William Pitt, the Prime Minister of England, sends him congratulations. "My dear Wilberforce, I can never enough congratulate you on such a glorious success." And then, having won this election in Yorkshire, Wilberforce decides to go to Yorkshire to visit with his constituents. And so he visits a lot of the leading men of the town. And while he's there, he bumps into an old friendship or an old acquaintance that he had known from the past. The guy's name is Isaac Milner. Now, Isaac Milner was actually his old schoolmaster from his grammar school days, all the way back when he was 7 years old, when they put him on the table and tell him to talk to the boys. And so he runs into Isaac Milner, his old grammar school teacher, again. And they strike up a conversation. And during the course of the conversation, Wilberforce says, "You know, I'm planning on going on another trip to France, and I need a guy to come with me. Do you want to come?" And Milner, because they've had such a great conversation, he says, "Yeah, I'd love to come." And so right then and there, they decide that Milner and Wilberforce will go together on the next vacation that he takes to France. And then the conversation drifts off to other things, and it continues on. And then partway further into the conversation, they start to talk about spiritual things, and he finds out Milner is a Methodist. And all of a sudden, why did I invite this guy to come with me on this trip? But it's too late. He's already extended the invitation, and Milner has already accepted. So he thinks, I'm stuck with him. He's going to go, and his mom's going to go, and some other extended family are going to go on this trip, and Milner will be tagging along. So the time comes for the trip, and they all cross the English Channel to come over here to France. And they have a great tour of France. In fact, William is very pleasantly surprised that Milner doesn't seem to be too serious about his Methodism. You know, he's not really strict about keeping the Sabbath, which a lot of them were. He's happy enough to go to all the high society entertainment, the balls and the dances and the card games and everything else. He doesn't even make it a habit of apparently doing extra praying on Sunday. All of these things that Methodists were known for. And William starts to think, this guy isn't too bad. This is the kind of Methodist that we should have in the world. He would later go on to say, Milner's religious principles had at this time little practical effect on his conduct. But on the ride, or while they're on their journey, while they're in Nice, France, they are going through someplace and they happen to see this book called The Rise and Progress of Religion in the Soul by the English author Philip Doddridge from about 50 to 100 years, about 50 years earlier. And as they're when they see the book, Milner says, that is a really good book. And it just sparks William's interest in this book. And so he asks him about it, and they start to read the book in the carriage as they're going from place to place through France. They get a little bit into it, and William is not a fan. This book is a little too radical for him. And so he wants to be done with it. And they start to get into, finally, arguments about spiritual things. William says this is ridiculous. He's too extreme about Christianity. Because Doddridge's argument is that it's not enough just to call yourself a Christian. It's not enough just to go to the Anglican Church. Christianity is a lifestyle. It's a full commitment to following Jesus Christ as a disciple. And William isn't a fan of this. But Milner argues the case. He says, no, that's a good book. And finally, Milner says, let's do this. Let's both of us read and study the Greek New Testament. Again, they both know Greek. Let's read and study the Greek New Testament to see, let the Greek New Testament determine if this book is true or not. Milner 4 says, okay, I'll agree with that. And so he starts into a study of the New Testament in Greek. And it doesn't take him very long, and he starts to find Doddridge in this book is right about these things. This starts the process of conversion in him. And he goes back to England. He starts to, for the first time in his life, get up early in the morning to read the Bible. He starts to pray. He starts to meditate. He's not immediately a Christian. It's a long process for him. He says, for many months, I was in a state of deepest depression. And even though he was always so popular and so extroverted, he starts to come more into himself, to spend time thinking about things, about the state of his soul. He wasn't ready to talk to anyone about it, certainly not his friend William Pitt. But he's thinking about these things. And at the end of November of that year, he writes to several of his closest friends, and he says, I'm going to be taking some alone time for the purpose of spiritual consideration. And he's very careful to assure them, I'm not an enthusiast, and I don't want you to think that because I'm thinking about religious things, I'm going to be a gloomy person. And most of his friends just don't know what to do with it. They're just like, he needs to be out more. But he does this, and he takes this time. And what he wanted to do in particular was he knew a guy from the past that he wanted some counsel from, John Newton. But there's a problem. William Wilberforce he's a minister of Parliament. He certainly can't be seen in public with a Methodist preacher. And so he writes a letter to John Newton. He says, which was delivered to John Newton right after church one Sunday. He says, sir, there is no need of apology for intruding when the subject is religion. I wish to have some serious conversation with you, and will take the liberty of calling on you for that purpose in half an hour, when, if you cannot receive me, you'll have the goodness to let me have a letter put into my hands at the door, naming a time and place for our meeting. I am sure you will hold yourself bound to let no one living know of this application or of my visit till I release you from the obligation. And it actually didn't work that day, but a couple days later, they're going to have their meeting. And William gets to the place where they're going to meet, and it's right on a square, and he doesn't go in the door. He walks around the square, and he walks around the square again. He does it like three times just to make sure no one's following him and no one's watching before he slips through the door to finally meet John Newton to talk about these things. Well, that continues for a few weeks, but by January, they are talking openly together and they are seen together. He says in his journal, "Expect to hear myself now universally given out to be a Methodist. May God grant that it may be said with truth." Now, at this point, his mother is still not very persuaded about this, and so he really works hard to try to live out the Christian virtues in his life, living with patience, humility, being mild-mannered, non-judgmental, to try to sway his mother to see that this has been a good thing that's happened in his life. One of his mother's friends, who's also an ardent anti-Methodist, said of William, "If this is madness, I hope that he will bite us all." And so we see he's very, his life is a good reflection of his beliefs. But around this time, he actually had two homes. He had one in London, and then he had a summer home. And he gives up his summer home. He thinks, I can use the money for better purposes. In fact, during the summer, I can just spend my time with friends. There, I have lots of friends with big estates that I can go from place to place. I don't have to be spending my money on this. So for the first time you see him, he's starting to pay attention to what he does with his time, what he does with his money, how he lives, being useful in the world that he's been placed in. And so pretty early on, he starts to learn about the African slave trade. Now, at this point, we have to talk about slavery at this time. We've already seen that there were several people that we've studied who had no problem with slavery. Slavery at this time was considered to be a necessary evil. It's like, well, slavery just happens. It's not something we love, but it's just the way that the world works. You can't get rid of it. It's been around forever. We just live with slavery. Also, you probably have an image in your mind of slavery as this terrible thing. But remember that most of the slavery is happening on this side of the Atlantic, and people over here, they don't have a very good understanding of what slavery is about. So, yeah, there's some bad things that happen, but they don't see it as particularly brutal. It's just something that you live with. It's one of those institutions many people believe that God had ordained that we just have to deal with it. Now, slavery comes about through what's known as the triangular trade, which is three voyages that ships would go on. And it was very profitable on all three legs of this voyage. The first was you would stock up your ship, if you're a slave trader, you stock up your ship in Europe with things like weapons, textiles, fabrics, jewelry, beads, alcohol, things like this. And then you would sail to Africa. Generally, actually, down here is the slave coast of Africa. And you would sell those things at a huge profit. And with the profit, you would buy slaves. We've talked a little bit about them and how they were captured during the time of John Newton. You'd buy slaves from here. Then you would sail from Africa to the West Indies, and you would sell these slaves, again, at a huge profit. And then, with the profit that you make, you would purchase sugar, rum, tobacco, and cotton, the main output of North and South America, and you would sell back to Europe, where you could sell all of that at a huge markup. So on all three legs of this voyage, it's very profitable for people. In the 1780s, which is the time that Wilberforce is in office, about 800,000 slaves are being taken during that decade. So about 80,000 individuals every year are being transported from Africa to North America. About half of these are being traded specifically by the British. All other European countries combined are doing the other half of them. And each slave on coming to the West Indies is sold for about 36 British pounds, which is the equivalent today of about $10,000. So again, there's a lot of money to be had in this market. But this part in here of the journey from Africa to the West Indies is known as the Middle Passage. And the Middle Passage is a horrible and brutal experience. About 15% of slaves die on the Middle Passage. Men are chained together, women are not. There's no bathroom, they're just laying there, as close packed together as you possibly can, for weeks to as many as 3 months. You do occasionally get about once a day, they would take you up to the top to be able to do some exercise for a few minutes, but they had netting there to keep yourself from throwing yourself overboard in an attempt to commit suicide. You lay there nearly or completely naked. Beatings, even to the point of death, were common. Torture was common. There's no law on these ships, so it's whatever the captain and his crew decide to do with you. And there was often absolute barbarity. these slaves are taken to the West Indies, and being in the zone of the near the equator, it's very hot. Many people believe that Europeans couldn't survive in this climate, so if the slaves weren't here to work, they felt that they couldn't work these plantations. But the plantations were known especially for sugar, because the Europeans, and especially the British, had come to love their sugar. In the year 1700, the average Briton consumed 4 pounds of sugar. A century later, in 1800, they were consuming 18 pounds of British per person per year. Or of sugar per person per year. Oops. Much of this sugar was used in their coffee and their tea and their hot chocolate. Today, average British American person, about 65 pounds. But that is what is fueling this. They want their sugar, and the slaves are the ones that are making these sugar plantations in the West Indies to be profitable. And unfortunately, very sadly, from an economic perspective, because sugar was so valuable of a commodity and it would sell for so much money, and because slaves, there were so many of them going over, the plantation owners had actually figured out it was economically more useful for you from a financial perspective to work your slaves to the point of death and then buy a new one than to treat them well and allow them to continue to live for years. So for this reason, the mortality rate in the first couple years in the Caribbean and South America was between 20 to 50% of slaves would die in the first couple years. And the average life expectancy in the Caribbean and South America was 7 to 10 years about, if you did survive the Middle Passage. North America was actually, interestingly, only a tiny fraction of the slaves went to North America. That was not a good place to go, but it was one of the few places where you would actually likely live for decades and the population could be self-sustaining. But the conditions in South America and the West Indies in particular were so brutal that they would die so constantly they had to have these new ones shipped in order to just keep the plantations going. Now, working with friends, Wilberforce learned a great deal about the slave trade. One of his friends, Clarkson, at this point was spending 16 hours a day researching the trade, interviewing people, talking to people, going around the entire country, getting information about it. And it is important to remember, as we talk about the slave trade, that many people were involved in the abolition of it. This was not just William Wilberforce. There was a whole crew of people. We're focusing on him, but there were many others who were involved in this. After he had gathered enough information, Wilberforce laid out this information to William Pitt, the Prime Minister. And Pitt, while Pitt was not a Christian, he did grow up in the Enlightenment tradition and felt that this was a terrible thing that was happening. And so Pitt enthusiastically encouraged Wilberforce to be the one to bring this to Parliament to end slavery and the slave trade. Meanwhile, this movement against slavery was gathering momentum. John Newton had taken so long to see the truth, but he finally saw it. And coming to a recognition of what he had been involved in, he wrote Thoughts Upon the African Slave Trade, which got a lot of publicity at this time. Another individual, Josiah Wedgwood, who was a pottery maker, created a seal and put it on a lot of his pottery. It's the Am I Not a Man and a Brother? And I'll let you pass this around. This is the seal that he would put on his pottery to remind people of the abolitionist cause. Well, on February 2nd, 1788, the motion is put out there in the House of Commons against the slave trade, and Wilberforce assumes that it's going to pass. He says, there's no doubt of the success. He says, the cause of our poor Africans goes on most prosperously. I trust there's little reason to doubt of the motion for the abolition of this horrid traffic in flesh and blood being carried in Parliament. But right when it got to the point where Wilberforce was going, so he presents that he's going to present the bill, but right when it's time for him to actually do it, right before then, he falls desperately ill. He can't go to Parliament to debate. He's so sick, in fact, that the doctors give him less than 2 weeks to live. And so, even though he's been preparing this whole thing, now it looks like they're not going to be able to have the vote. Eventually, William Pitt gets a bill through the Commons, but when it gets to the House of Lords, it fails. Remember, the House of Lords isn't elected. They are the aristocrats, and they hold many of these plantations. So they don't want it to go through. During this period of time, the arguments against abolition are advanced by these plantation owners. And there's a lot of arguments that they made. They said the stories are overblown. It's not that bad. Some said it's a beautiful cruise that they have from Africa to the West Indies. They said this trade is vital for the economy. To give it up would be to give up a huge economic advantage and let the French step in our place and do it. And the French are our enemies. So are we going to let them profit while we cut off this huge economic benefit to our empire? If we do this, the slaves are going to have revolts. Now, at this point, they're not working for the abolition of slavery, just the slave trade. That's the first step. You got to stop the new slaves before you can even stop slavery as a whole. And by the way, why are you so kind to these black people who live on the other side of the world? But what about all the people here in England who are poor? Like, let's pay attention to them, not those other people. And so these are the sorts of arguments that are being given. On July 11th, 1788, they do actually pass a law under William Pitt. They force a law through, but it is so tame. It has been, all of the significant parts of it have been cut out. The only thing that this law really does is it limits the number of slaves that can be transported in a ship to a more manageable level. You can't overcrowd your slave ship. That's the only thing that this law does. Now, Wilberforce is beginning to improve, and he realizes, I've just got to wait till next year before I'm going to be able to bring my bill again. But there's an abolition committee that is working double time to try to get people to understand what's going on. And so they publish a diagram of the slave ship Brooks. And this becomes a huge propaganda win for the abolitionist side, which I have printed out. I'm also going to distribute this for you to look at. The stunning thing about this diagram is that this shows what the ship was allowed to sail with after the law had been passed limiting overcrowding. In this diagram, 487 slaves are shown, but the Brooks had previously been on a voyage when it carried 744 slaves. Meanwhile, the Privy Council of England, of Great Britain, had interviewed John Newton and many others. They had 890 pages of information on the slave trade that they would present in the next session. 14 months of interviews. So by the next season, Wilberforce is mostly recovered, and he gives his speech on the 12th of May, 1789, 3.5 hours long. He does a very great job. He's a great orator. But then it descends into a lot of back and forth in Parliament. There's a fierce debate. Someone says 70 million British pounds worth of mortgages are at stake if we ban this trade. That's the equivalent of 18 to 19 billion U.S. dollars today. So you can see people are saying there's a huge economic cost to giving up this trade. And ultimately, they say we need to, even though the Privy Council has interviewed all these people, why not the House of Commons do their own interviews? And so it gets delayed again. Meanwhile, it's not as though slavery was the only thing that Wilberforce was working on. He goes and he visits a place called Cheddar Gorge, which is in England, and it's he's stunned by the poverty. And so he sets up this scheme with some Christian friends where they're going to start providing schools and other social benefits for these people. And he says, I'm going to pay everything that's needed. You guys set up schools, take care of these poor people. I will cover all of the cost of this. John Wesley hears about his campaign against slavery, and John Wesley is against slavery as well. And John Wesley sends him this very encouraging letter. He says, unless the divine power has raised you up to be as Athanasius against the world, I see not how you can go through your glorious enterprise in opposing that execrable villainy, which is the scandal of religion, of England, and of human nature. Unless God has raised you up for this very thing, you will be worn out by the opposition of men and devils. Talk about encouragement. But Wesley goes on to say, but if God be for you, who can be against you? Are all of them together stronger than God? Oh, be not weary of well-doing. And this continued for years. Wilberforce would present his bill. Sometimes the House of Commons would pass it. Sometimes they wouldn't. Every time, if it did manage to get to the House of Lords, the Lords would shoot it down. year after year after year. It didn't help that around this time the French had their own revolution, not just the American Revolution, but the French Revolution. And the French Revolution was all about the rights of man. That was a huge thing that they pushed, the rights of man. All men are created equal. And then the French went on to say, therefore there's no kings, therefore they guillotine their king, and they guillotine 40,000 of their aristocrats in an effort to make all men equal. And the British get very nervous about this. If this is what the rights of man is about, killing aristocrats, why would we want to set our slaves free because we think that they have rights? Then the slaves sometimes didn't help the process either. There was a slave revolt that happened in the West Indies. And the slaves started demanding something that they'd never demanded before. Not better food, better conditions, their rights. They started demanding their rights. And people said again, whoa, this dangerous influence of the French Revolution is spreading to our slaves through guys like William Wilberforce, who are encouraging this thinking that these slaves have rights, and it's causing riots in the colonies. And so one thing after another, stacks up, adds up, and keeps making the people very hesitant, the leaders very hesitant. Abolition is very popular among the British people as a whole. In fact, they even start a boycott of West Indian sugar. 300,000 people joined it to say, we're not buying West Indian sugar. So think about that. No sugar in your tea, no sugar in your coffee. But they say it's worth it to prevent this slave trade. Wilberforce is involved in some other things as well. The government, the abolitionists have this idea, and the government supports it, of why not we send some of the freed slaves back to Africa to start a colony in Sierra Leone. So the modern country of Sierra Leone was actually started as a colony by the British of freed slaves. And the idea was, if we can make a profitable colony down there that's not based on slavery, we can show the world that Africans can do more than be slaves. It's a great idea, but 50% of the slaves die within the first year because of the conditions once they get down there. And they can't, they're just dropped on the coast basically, and they're struggling to make it. And then this African war chief sees the British flag flying over this town, and so he attacks it and burns the place down. And so it's all these struggles. Eventually, it does eventually turn into something, but it's a very long process. Wilberforce is involved in that as well. He continues exposing the barbarity of the slave trade. One particularly vicious crime was condemned in Parliament, and the slave captain who had committed it then went on to stalk William Wilberforce to the point where he was fearful that this man might try to do him bodily harm. So he's going through this, and this is not an easy process for him. Another thing that Wilberforce, it was brought to his attention, is that India was ruled by the East India Company. It was a British company that had direct authority from Parliament to operate trade in India. And so it rules as its own country underneath Parliament. And Wilberforce hears no Christian missionaries are allowed in the domains of the East India Company. So he says, let's add language to the charter of the East India Company to allow Christians in, because to allow Christian missionaries to begin to spread the gospel in India. And they fight him on this. The government says, no, if we do this, then the Hindus will be very upset, and it'll create social turmoil, and then we won't be able to trade, and the East India Company won't be successful in what they're supposed to do. But he starts into this fight. And a few people had tried. William Carey did get into India as a missionary, basically an unauthorized missionary. The East India Company did not like him being there. But over multiple years, he's finally able to add language to the charter of the East India Company that grants Christian missionaries legal reason to be there to help improve the religion of India. In 1797, he publishes his most famous book. And the title, the short title, is A Practical View of the Prevailing Religious System of Professed Christians in the Higher and Middle Classes in This Country Contrasted with Real Christianity. Now, it's a pretty thick book, about 400 pages. I did not have the time to peruse that whole thing before our class. A little dense, I'd say. Pretty dense, but a couple quotes that come from it that I thought were beneficial. And some of this is in updated language. He says, what a difference it would be if our system of morality were based on the Bible instead of the standards devised by cultural Christians. And the whole point of the book is to speak to people like he had once been, who felt that they were acceptable, good people, because they went to the Anglican church once a week, and otherwise didn't really spend a lot of time thinking about spiritual things. He says there's four things that we ought to do with the Word of God. Admit it as the Word of God, commit it to our hearts and minds, submit to it, and transmit it to the world. He says there's no shortcut to holiness. It must be the business of our whole lives. Now, on April 15th, 1797, Easter Saturday, William Wilberforce is introduced to Barbara Ann Spooner. She was 25 or 26, he was 38. They're instantly attracted to each other. And they were married on May 30th of the same year. Did you catch that? That's 5 weeks. In fact, they were actually on track to be married sooner than that. But right in the middle of them getting to know each other, William Pitt calls Wilberforce back to Parliament from where he's at and says, there's huge wars going on in Europe. You have to be here in Parliament so that we can pass some stuff and get some stuff done. So Wilberforce, to his great disappointment and to the immense relief of his friends, is pulled back to Parliament for a few weeks, which he uses the opportunity to again present an abolition motion, which is soundly defeated. But he's finally back. On May 29th, he is back to the city of Bath in England, where he marries Barbara the next morning. After a week, he goes back to work in Parliament, feeling guilty for not having been duly diligent. April 3rd, 1798, his eighth motion for abolition lost the vote. February 25th, 1799, ninth motion lost the vote. Meanwhile, working on other things as well. A society for bettering the cause of the poor. Prison work to better situations within prisons. A British and foreign Bible society that he and others launched to get the Word of God into the hands of people. The Church Missionary Society that is founded by some individuals, including Charles Simeon, to send missionaries throughout the world. But around 1800, he's not able to make his motions for about 4 years just due to political situations or health reasons. Then in 1804, he gives another motion, defeated. 1805, another motion, defeated. They are able to send missionaries to India by this point. And then in 1806, William Pitt dies, his good friend. Now, William Pitt had always been a supporter of the abolitionist cause, and yet Pitt's personality was such that he would prioritize other things sometimes. He didn't have the force of mind. And so while it's a tragedy that Pitt dies, in some ways it's the best thing that can happen for the abolitionist cause, because now a new prime minister comes, takes his place, who's more forceful and who's also committed to the abolitionist cause. But by this point, there's been a shift. All of those years of working, decades of working for abolition, has finally resulted in a lot more support, not just in the House of Commons, but even in the House of Lords. The Slave Trade Act of 1807 was not technically introduced by Wilberforce. It was introduced by the actual government of the empire, but it was clearly the work of William Wilberforce. And it was presented by Lord Grenville and Charles James Fox. It passed 283-16, and Wilberforce was viewed as the main reason why it had come about. At that point, immediately after passing that bill, the entire parliament, the ministers of parliament, rose to their feet, applauding and cheering for one man. Wilberforce sat there, silently, in a daze, with tears running down his cheeks as his life's work had finally come to an end. 1808, the British abolish the slave trade. Not slavery, but the slave trade. America does the exact same thing that same year. 1808, the Americans say no more slaves enter the country, even though slavery does continue. Wilberforce uses the rest of his life to continue to push projects that will be beneficial to people. Education for poor children, reducing the use of the death sentence, supporting the development of a smallpox vaccine, even defending a sugar bill that would provide more income for many of the planters who had lost their livelihoods because of the slave trade. His enemies, he's actually working to help them because he finds the situation that they're in is very difficult. He and Barbara had 6 children. They had a very happy home life. He was a family man. He loved to play with his children. They'd play cricket, marbles, blind man's bluff. And he's seeing multiple of these efforts that he's put his work into over all of these years finally starting to pay off. He's also involved in founding the SPCA, Society for the Prevention of Cruelty to Animals. On February 1825, at 66 years old, he resigned his seat after 45 years as a Minister of Parliament. And he retired to spend more time with his family, to read, to visit the poor, and to spend time with his friends. There was one great tragedy left in his life, besides the loss of several of his children due to illnesses. His son William, so William Wilberforce the Younger, lived a very wild life after he moved out, and he had major troubles. In fact, in 1830, he fled the country to avoid being put in debtor's prison. And once it was discovered, the financial situation that his son was in, he owed £50,000, about $7 to $9 million. And at this point, it had to get paid, and Wilberforce recognized himself, he believed, to be responsible for this, and so he sets about to pay the entire thing. But in order to do so, he has to sell the only house that he has left. And he says, "What I shall miss most will be my books and my garden." And he has to basically spend the rest of his life living with friends or living with family members, just under their roofs, to his death. On July 26th of 1833, the House of Commons approved a bill for the abolition of slavery throughout the entire British Empire. And William Wilberforce died 2 days later.
Did his son become a Christian?
I don't believe so. Now, in the 2 minutes that we have left, there are 2 lessons that I, in particular, felt were beneficial. There's so much to learn from William, but 2 things that I saw that were so helpful to see in his writings from his life. The first one is his diligence, especially in his study of the Bible. Wilberforce, even though he was infinitely distractible, and even though he always wasn't very good at applying himself, he put the effort in to learn the Bible. He was a big fan of getting up early in the morning to study. He says, "This perpetual hurry of business and company ruins me in soul, if not in body. More solitude and earlier hours." He says, "In the calmness of the morning, before the mind is heated and weary by the turmoil of the day, you have a season of unusual importance for communing with God and with yourself." He challenges people to study. He says, "Carefully studying the Bible will reveal to us our own ignorance of these things. It will challenge us to reject a superficial understanding of Christianity and impress on us that it is imperative not to simply be religious or moral, but also to master the Bible intellectually, integrate its principles into our lives morally, and put into action what we have learned practically." Wilberforce understood this. You can't get to know someone if you don't spend time with them. And how much more true is that when we're talking about God, if you don't spend time with him? He says, "No one expects to attain to the height of learning or arts or power or wealth or military glory without vigorous resolution, strenuous diligence, and steady perseverance. Yet we expect to be Christians without labor, study, or inquiry." We already saw how his mind started to change and his carefulness with time began after he became a Christian. In fact, he would even keep a very precise log of his day at certain times in his life, at least. So, for example, in his journal one day, he says, "January 26th, he spent 4.5 hours in Commons, 5¾ hours in his studies, 1.5 hours in spiritual reading and meditation, 1¾ in necessary company, 1/4 in necessary relaxation, 1¼ getting dressed and undressed, and 8½ in bed, which leaves 30 minutes squandered." So he's very careful about this. The other lesson is the importance of then using what he has to be a blessing to others. He says, "It is the true duty of every man to promote the happiness of his fellow creatures to the utmost of his power. And we see that he uses everything he's been given to bless others and ultimately to abolish the slave trade, which leads to the abolition of slavery itself, which has dramatically changed our world, and to push Christian missionaries to India so that there will be Christians from India today. So all of that, I think it's encouraging for us. Let's pray. We're grateful, Lord, for getting to spend this hour thinking about William Wilberforce. And he was not a perfect man. He had his flaws, but he sought to serve you with his life. Grant us that we would also be diligent with our time, use it for your glory, and seek to be a benefit to our fellow man. In Jesus' name, amen.
Amen.